experience-based learning has nothing to do with how smart you are, how good your cognitive abilities are. It's literally a rewiring of your brain, and it happens to all humans, and nobody can shake it.
Economics relies heavily on some basic assumptions about how people react to financial situations. But real people in the real world often deviate from those traditional economic models. And when they do, economists need to understand why.
And these other explanations are tightly linked to us being humans, to not work like this perfect computer, which perfectly uses all the information that's provided to come to the correct conclusion. People might not get that exactly right. They might have limited attention. People might be making mistakes. My name is Ulrike Malmendier, and I'm a professor of finance and a professor of economics here at UC Berkeley. I also serve on the German Council of Economic Advisors to the German government.
Malmendier is a behavioral economist whose innovative research has shown that people's financial decisions are heavily swayed by their past experiences. She sat down with journalist Rhoda Metcalf to discuss how behavioral economics is helping the field of economics keep up with the times.
Traditional economic theory tends to assume that people always react in the same way to an economic opportunity. But behavioral economists like yourself say that's not how it works. People are not consistent. They're actually driven by a lot of psychological factors that economists need to consider. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, I'd love to. The most recent wave of behavioral economics tries to emphasize that we are living, breathing organisms who change over the course of our life, who, if we have good or bad experiences, our willingness to take risk will change over our lives. And that's, of course, scary for an economist who just wants to study data and doesn't want to mess around with different assumptions. But it will make it more realistic. And the good news is, we have a lot of evidence from neighboring STEM fields, whether it's cognitive science, whether it's psychiatry, neuroscience, biology, medicine. There's lots of evidence we can actually start incorporating into our models, and that will help us to better understand why the same stimulus might lead to a very different reaction, whether you look pre or post great financial crisis, pre or post pandemic, or whatever experience you want to look at.
Right. So it helps to solve the conundrum that sometimes your data doesn't always follow the same route that you expect.
Exactly. And of course, the hope is it does so in a predictable way. You know, just before the financial crisis, the young people have mostly seen good outcomes and might be too optimistic in their attitudes and beliefs, say housing. They might think house prices will just always increase no matter what. Older generations are maybe a little bit wiser because they've seen more ups and downs. Now the great financial crisis hits, in particular the mortgage crisis hits, and that hugely affects how the younger generation looks at the value of being a homeowner, for example, and should drastically change them and make them, you know, more cautious about absolutely having to buy a home, maybe waiting a little bit for wealth accumulation and not go for the riskiest, most risky type of mortgage financing.
So can you give me an example of a behavioral economics concept or theory that traditional economics would not explain?
Yeah, if I can start from work I've done on overconfidence.
Okay.
So for years and decades, researchers have wondered why so many CEOs, successful CEOs, go out and go on an acquisition spree and try to acquire companies which maybe even work in industries they're not so familiar with. But somehow, in particular, successful CEOs tend to think in many circumstances that, you know, they were super successful in their own company. They raised the market valuation of their company. Why not take over that other company and do the same? They get a little bit convinced that everything they touch turns into gold. And that's something that a lot of practitioners have talked about. So we went out and said, well, let us try to understand these acquisitions where you systematically have a negative reaction in the market. Everybody thinks it's a bad idea, but the guy keeps going and puts through with it. Mm-hmm. And it turns out that very powerfully, you can predict these behaviors by individual level measures of overconfidence.
I mean, how do you decide how much overconfidence a particular CEO has, though? Are there measures for that?
Yeah, it's very hard because, of course, if you were just, for example, to go by what they say, you know, pushing their strategy, talking super optimistically, well, that's not a measure of overconfidence. That's the job of a CEO to sound optimistic about what they're doing. So what my co-author, Jeff Tate, at the University of Maryland and I did is we basically looked for ways to discover who puts their money where their mouth is. And specifically, what I mean is that some CEOs put a lot of their own personal money in their company.
Okay.
Some really seem to believe that the world hasn't understood how great their company is and that under their glorious leadership, it will keep increasing and put a lot of their own personal money in it. So with the best intentions, right? They're not trying to cheat anybody. They're really believing in it. And exactly those CEOs do too many mergers. They go into industries where they don't really know so much about it. So that's basically the innovation we came up, precisely finding a measure that worked in this context.
All right. So there was another example that you used, which I thought was very interesting. The example of the generation of Germans who grew up on either side of the Berlin Wall, which I guess came down around the end of the 1980s. And as you explain in your work, now these two groups have quite different investment behaviors. So what's going on there?
Yeah, so that is another behavioral factor I'm really interested in. And we've coined the word experience effects or experience-based learnings to describe it. So looking back in the past of how you got here, you know, did you grow up with a silver spoon in the mouth or did you grow up in poverty in a family where there was a scarcity of food? Will have a lasting impact on you. That will affect you, that will affect your brain, that will rewire your brain. And these kind of experiences stay with you. So if you're compared to people who look exactly the same today, same job, same prospects, same wealth, etc., how they got there, their past experiences, has a huge influence on their financial decision, on their labor choices, on everything. Now, the good thing in the East-West Germany example is that after the reunification, East and West Germans pretty much live in the same world and they have the same institutional environment. And so we can hold all of these circumstances constant and can ask the question, do we still detect long-lasting effects of having grown up under communism in a world where the regime talked very negative about capital markets and capital market investments, where the stock exchange under Lenin is the height of the enemy to be combated.
It's sort of the height of capitalism.
Exactly, exactly that. And does that stay with you? And that's precisely what we found. People who grew up in the GDR in East Germany, who often reported, look, I was protesting against the regime. I went on the streets. I was part of these demonstrations. I risked my life to get to change. And yet I have to admit that what I was exposed to in terms of propaganda, in terms of view of the world, it's kind of staying with me. I can't shake it easily. And that's kind of what we find with respect to stock market investment and attitudes towards capital markets and stock market more generally. There's a much more negative attitude and much less willingness to invest in capital markets compared to West Germans. What's super interesting is that it's colored by how you experience your life in East Germany.
Right.
If you had a pretty good life in East Germany, for example, you know, they were pretty good at sports. There was lots of subsidization and actually doping to achieve like gold medals in the Olympic Games and so on. And if you lived in a village or in a city where there were celebrated sports stars, that was just one example of having a somewhat good life, then you definitely stick to the old ideology. If instead you really suffered under the old regime, there was, for example, terrible air pollution. If you lived in one of these areas that was affected, or you lived in a culturally religious, traditionally religious area, and religion was, of course, suppressed, then you really had your reservations against that communist regime. And as a result, now you're embracing the change and you're much more ready to say, market economy is good. I love stock market investment. I'm ready to do this.
Right. So if you didn't do well under communism, you're more likely to be invested in the stock market than if you had a good experience.
Exactly. And what is important to emphasize is we're not necessarily talking about doing well under communism or not financially, like whether your wealth was good or bad. No, it might have been physically, it might have been culturally, and yet it translates into these financial decisions.
Right. Interesting. You use the example of Henry Wallach, who was a member of the U.S. Federal Reserve Board. And you argue that his experiences in his youth had a big impact on the kind of policy decisions that he made later as a federal leader. So why do you use that example?
What I love about this example is that it conveys very well a second important point about behavioral economics, namely that people often thought that these deviations happen only, you know, to the average consumer or the average investor, the person on the street. A smart person, somebody who gets a PhD in economics, teaches at Yale and rises the rank at the Federal Reserve, would surely not make these type of behavioral biases. And in fact, we see that nobody can shake them. Even somebody like Henry Wallach, who had a most successful career as an economist in the US after having, you know, being born in Germany in 1914, grown up and seen in his youth the Weimar hyperinflation, then left with his family for ultimately the US. This person who clearly knew that now in the US, he was in a different country with a different monetary system in a different decade than the Weimar hyperinflation, still could not shake that experience. And to this day, holds the record of voting against proposals of the Fed chairperson that, you know, one could lower interest rate. He was the one always warning that inflation is around the corner and nobody really understands how severe the dangers are. And so it's not a big jump to think, oh, probably he was quite scarred by what he personally experienced in Germany. So he is just a really good example for illustrating how these biases, in this case, experience-based learning, has nothing to do with how smart you are, how good your cognitive abilities are. It's literally a rewiring of your brain that happens to humans, and it happens to all humans, and nobody can shake it.
Wow. How do traditional economists react to the kind of work you do, this behavioral economics? Do you get pushback?
Yeah, in particular, this last aspect we are talking about, that even people who are very smart, very successful, that they still are subject to biases, systematic biases. I started off working on things like CEO overconfidence, mm-hmm. and they are definitely felt the pushback. People would look at me and say, well, I interview CEOs, I talk to CEOs, I work with them. They're very smart. How can you argue that they are overconfident? Now, the good side about economics is it is a very data-driven discipline.
Right.
So already early on, when, for example, I presented this CEO overconfidence work in Chicago, which traditionally is the height of the neoclassical models mm-hmm. and rational financial economics, people were willing to listen to me because I was showing data that was really hard to explain otherwise. And I have to admit, it was helpful that we had the great financial crisis. I'm not sure whether my work on depression babies and learning from inflation experiences would have landed so well and would have been published so well if people hadn't realized, well, something is deeply wrong with the models we have been using so far. So again, being a data-driven science is really helpful if you come to the table with a very disruptive new way of looking at things.
Right. Okay. So finally, do you think that including behavioral economics in mainstream economic models could affect broader issues like, you know, inequality, for example?
Yeah. So in the case of experience effects, mm-hmm. it directs the attention towards differences in individual people's histories. If today there are two people and they have the same initial education, they have the same financial situation, and you want to say, okay, so they're equal, let's give them equal opportunities, and that's all we need to do to advance, say, a minority group, if one of them is from a minority group,
right.
You would be wrong, because the scarring experiences would stay with them and might prevent them to go towards an educational investment or more risky career path, given how much they've been scarred in the past. So thinking about, for example, COVID and how COVID has affected different ethnic and racial groups differently tells us that going forward, their choices on the financial side, on the career side, on work from home versus work in person will be differently affected by these past experiences, even if they are over, right? Even if you're kind of back to pre-COVID-19 right now. And so automatically experience effect says differences in past experiences need to be taken into account. And those are, of course, crucial in terms of addressing inequality. It's not enough to give the same opportunities right now. We might need to give some people more encouragement than others, expose them actively to positive experiences in order to change the equilibrium.
Well, that's great. So, Ulrike Malmendier, thank you so much for giving us a better understanding of this very interesting field.
Thank you so much. This was really an interesting conversation.
Again, that was economist Ulrike Malmendier speaking with journalist Rhoda Metcalf. Look for Malmendier's article on behavioral economics in the March issue of Finance and Development magazine. And look for more IMF podcasts wherever you get your podcasts. You can also follow us on X, what used to be Twitter, at IMF_podcast. I'm Bruce Edwards.
And I'm Rhoda Metcalf. Thanks for listening.